Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski.
And I'm Mitch Teich. We spoke a few weeks ago with occasional Lake Effect contributor Arna Michaelis, along with Pardeep Singh Kalika, about their book, The Gift of Our Wounds, and their unlikely friendship that blossomed after the Sikh temple shooting in Oak Creek. But that's not the only recent book by Michaelis, a former white supremacist.
He's also the author of the memoir My Life After Hate, which looks back at, as he describes it, his former racist skinhead past and its roots. It examines his transformation from his central role in the white power movement of the 80s and 90s to his work today, which he terms waging peace. Michaelis is back in the studio with us. Welcome back to Lake Effect.
Thank you so much, Audrey. It's always awesome to be here and really looking forward to our conversation.
Me too. So I was going through your book, My Life After Hate, and oddly enough, but also helpful enough, was that it's a teacher's edition. So there's like writing prompts and discussion prompts and things like that. But I have to, you know, just for our listeners to know, I've known you only as you are today, as Arna Michaelis, the former neo-Nazi, the great, big, lovable guy who we talk about nerdy things with, you know, and all that kind of stuff. But this book was really my first look into the weight of what you used to be, you know, because there's some pretty graphic depictions of, you know, the street fights you used to get into or just your everyday reality.
Right.
And it's, you know, kind of transported me to the alternate universe of Arna, so to speak. So in your perspective, when you were beginning to write this, was it difficult to decide to be so candid in revealing your journey of what you used to be?
Yeah, absolutely. It was really my impetus to write the book was things that were going wrong in my life at the time, which was 2006, 2007. And it was actually like a really brutal heartbreak that I was going through. I had dated this woman for a little bit and I was like madly in love with her and it didn't work out. And I blame myself for that, and I blame my past. Like, I kind of felt like, where do I get off thinking that I'm going to go riding off into the sunset with a beautiful woman who loves me after all the harm that I'd done, after all the people that I had hurt? And I realized at that point I had to reconcile my past. I had to go there and face it with openness and honesty. And it also occurred to me that in the process of doing that, if I can help other people learn from my mistakes and hopefully not make them in the first place, then in this process of catharsis, I can also make the world a better place. And so that all was front and center as I wrote. And I knew that I had to go deep. Like, I had to go back to who I was, and I had to think and talk and act on the page the same way that I used to, with the language, with and not necessarily, like, cussing. I still cuss like a sailor. I got no problem with that. But it, like, with using racial slurs or other word, which nowadays, like, racial slurs hurt me because they dehumanize people that I love dearly. Very important people in my life. Back then, every other word was a racial slur. It was like just my bread and butter on a daily thing. So if I'm writing like that and I'm writing dialogue about how I used to talk, I have to be real. And it sucked to go back there. The chapters in that book that are steps back in time and glimpses of who I was and where I was were really difficult to write. And they're still very difficult for me to read. And I would say in the book, like, if I could barely write this, who's going to want to read it? And that occurs to me for sure. But I really, having read other people's memoirs, and I actually was immensely inspired by the autobiographies of Frederick Douglass, which he's just such a brilliant, was a brilliant man and was such a brilliant writer. That kind of openness and honesty was a goal of mine, and that's where all that came from.
Looking back on it, there's the whole concept of violence versus thought, and obviously thought has overcome what used to be your very violent life. So how do you put yourself, so to say, like, in check every day? Because you admit you're still struggling with your anger. You still struggle with the things that you did and coming to terms with,
right?
Like you said before, like, how do I deserve this when I've done this?
Right.
So which is more difficult for you, the violence versus thought on that plane?
I started a meditation practice in 2009, and I took a formal refuge vow in 2014, saying, like, I am officially a Buddhist. My Tibetan name is Nyingchen Chosum, which means renunciation Dharma bridge. Buddhism and the Dharma, which is the teachings of the Buddha, is a daily practice for me. And in the simplest sense, my interruption to the cycle of violence is just a breath. A meditation is just about noticing your breath and being engaged with it. And when our mind is focused on our breath for a split second, it's not worrying about the future. It's not regretting the past. It is absolutely present where we are here and now. And that's really what Buddhism is all about. And the power that that breath has to interrupt violence is just immense. And I do still struggle with anger issues. For 25 years of my life, my response to conflict, it was instant violence. And so nowadays, you know, somebody cuts me off in traffic or whatever, like little innocuous offenses, I still get that like rush of like, ugh. I want to put my fist in something, but instead I take a breath and I feel that breath and I bring myself present to it. And when I come back, even nanoseconds later, now the offense, whatever that is, has lost a lot of its power. And I can move on to other things and I can have my mind available for what I want it for rather than what this external thing is trying to take over.
Do you think keeping up your new life goals and lifestyle would be possible had you not embraced Buddhism? You know, do you think you would have had to find some other structured outlet in order to not revert back to the habits?
Yeah, absolutely. The meditation for me is it empowers everything I do. And I don't think that I could have done it otherwise. Being a student of the Dharma and studying spirituality and being so fortunate to work with amazing Sikhs and Christians and Muslims and Jews and Hindus, you know, people of every spiritual background and people who are secular humanists, you see the common themes in all of those. And to me, really, it's a human need to be at peace with change, which I think is throughout the history of our species has always been a real challenge for people. And so all these ways have been whipped up to try to find that peace. And if from, you know, the three Abrahamic religions, it's faith in God and faith in God's will. And that just doesn't work for me personally. I've never been into like higher power stuff, supernatural things. But had I not found Buddhism, I think I could not have done this without some other kind of spiritual practice. Whether I'm praying or I'm meditating, I needed that device and that tool to cultivate and practice my own inner peace. Otherwise, there's no way I could do any of this work.
You mentioned we need to be at peace with change, but a large part of your life and part of the appeal of being a skinhead and in that group was that you gripped so fiercely to racist dogma or spin developed on facts. And in your book, you referenced that, yes, these are technically facts that we used. And I'm curious, just with today's current climate of fake news and spin,
right,
and just the overemphasis of like what is fact, what is not fact, or this is a fact, but this is interpreted this way.
Right.
How do you view that today when it's coming from even more people and organizations and higher power, and it's not just a group of skinheads in an attic in River West?
Yeah, exactly. It's incredibly imposing nowadays. Back in our day, this was all pre-internet. So we would like have to find a physical piece of paper to show people and be like, look, this proves that the Jews are doing this, this, and that. And, you know, it proves all these paranoid conspiracy theories. Today, the same process happens. And I think the way to understand it all is to break it down that people are getting really upset or really passionate about things that they have zero firsthand experience of. And so when I'm talking to people today, whether it's someone who's in the Klan or someone who's in like far right political ideology or far left political ideology, I always go like, let's talk about you and your personal experience. What have you seen, felt with your own eyes in person? And let's talk about that. Set aside all this extraneous information for a minute. And again, this is Buddhism 101. We're bringing ourselves present. We're not sitting here stewing about something we read on Facebook this morning. Not that that information isn't valid, but I think we have to challenge ourselves to ask how much weight we're going to give it. And perception is reality. That was true in the Stone Age, it was true 1,000 years ago, and it's like triply true today. Our perception is kind of hyper amplified beyond where it ever has been. And I think personally, for the sake of my own inner peace, not that I don't take in for information from Facebook and things like that. It's part of living in today's society. But I always want to come back to my personal experience, present right now, this moment, what is going on in my life, what have I experienced, and we need to cultivate more of that. And it's incredibly difficult. There's the deck is stacked so against it, and there are people absolutely who are manipulating that for the sake of power.
You have a great passage in this book. This was obviously published and completed a few years back. Obama just won his first presidency. You write a great passage about your excitement to be part of, like, in that campaign of that first time.
Yep.
But then you also come to reflect on, okay, he's in office, but things haven't changed as, like,
right,
everyone hoped, that of the great fervor and passion for change that everyone had.
Right.
You know, and time has passed. He's had two terms. Now we have President Trump in office. So has your view of politicians changed or not changed? Or, you know, what concerns you the most with this current term? Because it's an even more of a juxtaposition, you know? And yet, as you say, you have to remain constant in centering things around your experience. But
exactly,
with your experience of having both extremes in your life, what's your view of it today?
I did a talk at the East London Mosque. It was the oldest mosque in London, and I had a great audience and amazing conversation afterwards. And one of the guys, you know, British Muslim guy who I'm talking to afterwards, said, you know, you're so well-spoken and your ideas are great. Like, you should really get into politics. And I was like, dude, I thought you liked me. Why would you wish that upon me? I honestly, after 2008, it just really sunk into me that and it's not even just the American political landscape, it's politics anywhere, is just such a filthy, dirty game, and there's so much inertia, like heading in the wrong direction with stuff that is in motion, and there's so much inertia of an object at rest for things that should be in motion and that aren't. That it's really discouraging to me on all kinds of levels. I personally will never get into politics because I think working with people face to face is the best, and cultivating things at a grassroots level. My work and especially everything I've learned from working with party, it's really about cultivating things like compassion and forgiveness and kindness in our society. And if our society can adopt those practices, the politics will take care of itself. I believe wholeheartedly that the government, as well as media, because both of these things get seen as like some kind of ominous alien external force that's manipulating people in our society. It is our society. The government is a reflection of our collective social consciousness. And if our collective social consciousness is dominated by fear and loathing, the government will reflect that, as will the media. If we want to change what the media does, if we want to change what the government does, we have to change ourselves first and foremost. Until we do that, the government and the media will reflect the strife that exists in our society because inner peace is so, it's such a rare thing nowadays. So, I'm discouraged by politics. At the same time, like, to quote President Obama, who I still absolutely love, he's my favorite president ever. I wish I could have voted for him again. But to quote him, like, don't boo, vote. And I would say also, like, yeah, marching, protesting, that's all great. But if you're doing that without voting, you're involved in romantic violence the same way I was as a skinhead. You're thinking that this immersing yourself in this conflict and just getting all whipped up and enamored of the fight, of the conflict, of the thrill that of adrenaline that you get, whether you're in a street fight or you're in a march and you're getting sprayed by cops with pepper spray, if you're doing that without voting, I think it makes things worse.
That's a great lead into my next question, which I have a quote from your book where it says, "Every day was a rally when you were a skinhead." So I'm curious, what's your everyday for you now?
That's a great question. Every day is still a rally for me.
Just a different kind.
Exactly. I think about cognitive dissonance a lot, the human tendency to spin information to suit our preconceived notions. And when you hear the term cognitive dissonance, it's typically someone accusing someone else of suffering from it. And that's interesting to me because I think every single human being on Earth suffers from cognitive dissonance. And if we can convince ourselves that my political team or whatever, my way of thinking is the lone way of not – that's free from cognitive dissonance, that's the ultimate cognitive dissonance. Being at peace with cognitive dissonance, it lets understand that our mind is spinning reality to suit some preconceived notion, and then let's ask ourselves, what preconceived notion do we want to be our lens? So for me, that preconceived notion is compassion. It's forgiveness. It's love. It's kindness. And it takes a lot of energy. It takes a lot of challenge to look at the world through that lens on an ongoing basis, especially in times of political strife, especially in times when white supremacy, systemic racism, these very real social illnesses are still causing so much damage. But those lenses of love and forgiveness and kindness and gratitude are all – that's the antidote. That's the cure for those things. And that's why my rally every day is – not giving up faith in humanity and not giving up faith in the basic goodness of our collective human experience. And yes, it absolutely takes an immense amount of energy. So that's why you got to be rallying for it every day.
Arno Michaelis is an occasional Lake Effect contributor and author of the memoir, My Life After Hate. You'll find more information, more of this interview, and you can listen to his award-winning essay for this show at WUWM.com.